Yeah, I have a small nonprofit called the Clearview Project, which we've been working with monks and nuns who are imprisoned in Burma, and trying to do advocacy around them and all political prisoners in Burma, and also to get them food, medicine, clothing via their families, get it to them in prison. And so we've been raising money for that, and we continue to since the Saffron Revolution in the fall of 2007. And then I'm also working with, it's a whole other discussion, a vast community of untouchable Buddhists in India, people called Dalit. And mostly I've been working through an offshoot of, I think, FWBO is sitting here? Yeah, through an offshoot of theirs in India, as they really began this incredible work there with the untouchable community. And I've been working very closely with them and teaching at a school for untouchable youth in Nagpur, which is kind of, it's in the state of Maharashtra, but it's kind of geographically the center of India. And it's a wonderful school for about, 70 or 80 youth, maybe from 19 to 21 or 22. And they're from all over India. And they are from extraordinarily sort of impoverished and oppressed circumstances. And they're just completely alive, like young people are everywhere, we'll give them the chance. And they have this 10-month program where they meditate and practice twice a day, very strong practice. They're trained, and they're trained to lead meditation. And they're given some basic, good basic Buddhist education in the sutras and the teachings of Theravada and Mahayana. And they're also given skills in sort of community organizing. So some of them go on to school, to university, or go to learn. They also have a computer school at the school that I'm working, Nagaloka, so they can learn a skill that's in great demand in India. And quite a number of them go back to their villages and start meditation groups and start doing kind of human rights advocacy. It's wonderful. So I'm sort of committed to going there annually. And I'm going back there in the winter. And I just love being with them. So that's a little background. But that's not what I was going to talk about. Or it is sort of related to what I was going to talk about. I'd like to talk about sort of how do you walk the Bodhisattva path, which is the path that is the ground of our school. I don't know about here, at Berkeley Zen Center, we chant the Bodhisattva vows often. We chant them at the end of, we could chant it at the end of the lecture. I don't know if you do that regularly. Yeah. So I'd like to talk a little about that. And I've been sort of tinkering around, I've been circling around this subject for a month or so. And what I found that I also like to do at the end is sing you a song. Or actually, we will sing a song together. I will teach you the chorus, and it is it's about how to be a bodhisattva in difficult circumstances. You may have heard it, or you may not have, but it certainly changes the energy. So I'm sort of talking, I'm not going to read, but I have a book that came out last year called The Bodhisattva's Embrace. And the title refers to a text of Ehe Dogen. We, in our school, we study Dogen a lot. I assume that you probably do the same. He was a 13th century Zen master who really carried what he saw as the essence of Zen in China to Japan and established the first formal Soto meditation center outside of Kyoto. And he wrote a piece in his Shogogenzo, Treasury of the True Dharma Eye. In Japanese, it's called Bodhisattva Shishobo, which I had the privilege of translating working with Shohaku Okamura Roshi, and we translated as the Bodhisattvas for Embracing Dharmas, as a fairly literal translation. It's also, you can find it in Moon and a Dewdrop. Kaz translates it, Kaz Tanahashi translates it as the Bodhisattva's Four Methods of Guidance. So, I really like this image of embrace. And what I wrote, to embrace is to encircle. I wrap my arms around you, you put your arms around me. To embrace is to unify, to make one of two. It's an act of love. In embrace, the limits of body, skin, feelings, and thoughts are all transcended. Seen at a distance, two beings are one. So when we look down, when the Buddhas look down at beings in embrace, they can't distinguish separate beings. There are many ways to embrace. Sometimes the literal. Sometimes the most effective way to embrace someone, their thoughts and feelings, is just take a walk with them side by side. Sometimes an argument is an embrace. All of these are manifestations of non-separation. And then the interesting thing, which came to me as I was talking about this not so long ago, the interesting thing about the notion of embrace is that it also necessarily implies a moment in which you let go, in which you, so there's interdependence and unification and merging, and then you also have to, there's a moment when you step back. I mean, you all know this. It's like if somebody, if you're in a hug and somebody holds on too long, it kind of gets uncomfortable. You know, there's a moment, there's a mysterious moment when you let go. In the same way that you breathe in, which is quite wonderful, and then there's a turning moment when you breathe out and you let go. So, in another of his fascicles, Genjo Koan, towards the beginning, Dogen says, leaping beyond the one and many. So the embrace that I'm talking about is leaping beyond the one and the many. And what this fascicle does is it tells you how to do this. It's the Bodhisattva's for embracing dharma. So the Bodhisattva, you could translate bodhisattva in various ways as enlightened being, or an enlightenment being, embodying enlightenment, or an enlightening being. And this practice, these embracing dharmas or these methods of guidance are the way a realized bodhisattva naturally practices, just automatically, because their whole path has led to that culmination. And for those of us who are on the path and haven't gotten there, and at least I refer to myself and not necessarily to anyone else in the room, because you're all realized bodhisattvas. It's how we practice. It's what we have to cultivate in order to enact bodhisattva practice, in order to walk on this path. So there are four methods. Four. One, two, three, four. They are, this is a traditional teaching. So they are giving or dana, offering, kind speech, beneficial action, and what Dogen calls identity action, which seems like a slightly abstract term, but it has a lot of, once you unpack it, for me it has a lot of meaning. Identity action means being in identity, being in sameness, being in unity with another being. Giving is the essential action that flows through all of these. And that's basically what I'm going to speak about. But identity action is the spirit in which you do this. It's the spirit of equality. Without that, then giving becomes charity. It can become dualistic. It can become even more intensely me and you, or us and them, rather than all of us together. So I was thinking about the background of this fascicle. I'll tell you a little about it. Dogen returned to China in his early 20s, returned to Japan in 1223 after training in China and meeting his teacher, Ru Jing. And he came back and established, in very short order, established what was supposed to be, you know, a quite beautiful practice place with formal, with kind of all the buildings and all the kind of architecture and setup that he had found in the traditional Zen temples in China. And this was the first space like this in Japan. And they practiced happily there. It was quite a mix of monks and lay people, because Kyoto was a very cosmopolitan place. And he began to write Shobo Genzo and other pieces that were the treasures that were really handed down to us over those, you know, 600 years, 700 years. Something happened in 1233 that is unclear. But there was a lot of sectarian tension, as there are in any organized religion. And the monks, we think of monks as, you know, peaceful, quiet, wearing their robes, you know, but they would like burn down each other's temples and go attack each other's with clubs and swords. You know, they didn't really screw around. You know, it's like it was sectarian warfare some places. So at some point, Dogen picked up in 1233 in the fall, they just closed the temple. They packed up all their stuff and moved to the Wild West, to the area, the piece of land that has now become Eheiji, one of the central training temples of Soto Zen. And this happened very quickly. And there's no documentation of the direct cause or anything. I've really researched and I've talked to scholars. But they all presume that it was sectarian tension, sectarian violence, and he had to leave. They all had to leave. So this fascicle was written about 2 months before they left. And my speculation is that this was his teaching to his community. So here's what we have to do in this really, really difficult situation. We have to practice generosity. We have to practice kind speech when we feel like there's other kinds of speech that we would like to utter. We have to practice beneficial action when we might like to get out the clubs and swords. And we have to practice identity action because as human beings, as bodhisattvas, as the enactment of the embodiment of Buddha nature, we are essentially not different from those who are opposed to us. This is a really difficult teaching, especially in conflict. So I think this was probably his advice to his community, and very possibly his own way of writing and thinking himself into having a proper perspective himself on what could only have been a very painful situation. So that's my notion of the context. And I think that that's the context that I can imagine using this in. That's the context in which you encounter, you know, when you think about imprisoned monks in Burma. And when you think about untouchable people, when you think about people who are victims of racism here, when you think about all of the incredible oppression and suffering that we variously encounter in our lives. This is a method of practicing. So, I'm just going to talk about giving a bit. And it's really interesting. I think this also kind of bears out for me where what the context was, because the way he begins, I think, is unusual. You know, if you're thinking about it, he says, giving means not to be greedy, okay? It means not to want something for yourself. Not to be greedy means not to crave. And then there's a leap. Not to crave means, in worldly expression, not to flatter. It's like, would any of us logically go there? You know, not, I mean, if I were writing, it's like speaking about desire, speaking about greed, you know, it's like all of a sudden to leap to something that is about actually how you conduct your relationships with others. In Kaz Tanahashi's translation, it's something like not to crave means not to curry favor. Just another take on flatter. So, in other words, we're not going to, it's a way of practicing that right from the outset, undercuts a hierarchical way of thinking of, say, you know, flat earth, and all of us kind of know about this, whether when we look inside ourselves, you know, you flatter because you want something for yourself. And you want something for yourself from someone whom you think has it, perhaps, or is in some position that's higher than you. Sometimes it's something very simple. It's like, you know, you flatter because you want them to recognize you. You know, because you flatter because you want equality. And yet, a person, I've talked with a lot of people, and this came up at other talks, like, people know when they're being flattered, and it generally makes them uncomfortable, because they're being put in a, they're being projected upon, or they're being put in a position. And people, if I look at my energy, and I've seen myself do this in the not so distant past, wanting approval or wanting someone to see me as an equal. And when I look inside myself, there is a kind of squirmy, uncomfortable feeling. And I think in Dogen's context, you know, he could have played politics. I think this is what he's referring to. He could have played politics and somehow had another outcome other than fleeing, perhaps. But he didn't want to do that. He just thought, it's better for us to go and establish ourselves independently. So, not to flatter means it points to the last of these methods. It points to equality. Come to each person on the ground of equality, not on the ground of who you think they are, who you want them to think you are. And that's what a bodhisattva does. They meet each person equally. And when we sing this song, you'll hear that. Bodhisattva meets each person in exactly the context of that person can understand. So if there are bodhisattvas among us, and if they are, you can find them waiting tables, you can find them driving a bus, you can find them in any ordinary context of life, and you recognize when that person is meeting you just equally as a full person, and then one rises to the challenge to meet that person equally, not as somebody who's serving you, but as somebody who's offering you something, and then they're giving. They're doing that practice, and what do you give back? So then he talks about giving. It is like offering treasures that are going to be discarded to people we do not know. And then give flowers that are blooming on the mountains, flowers that are blooming on the distant mountains to the Tathagata. Just a beautiful sentiment. How do you do that? You don't own those flowers. They're not yours to give away. They're far away, and you don't know who or what the hell the Tathagata is. But you just offer it. Because we are in identity with the whole world. When I was in Michael's studio, and there were some landscapes of these hills, there were no flowers. There's probably a flower season. But the hills themselves, to see them and to paint them, is in some mysterious way to give the hills to the hills. And so this is always giving, to think of whatever you encounter with the spirit of gratitude and generosity and equality. Without those hills, there would be no valleys. Without the hills, without the distant hills here, there would be no Jokoji. And we wouldn't be sitting here. That's what's been given to us. And so, what is it that we give back of ourselves? That's always the question. He says, when the way is entrusted to the way, when you let things be themselves, when you let people be exactly themselves, that's entrusting the way to the way. We attain the way. When we attain the way unfailingly continues to be entrusted to the way. When we are ourselves, everything comes forth naturally. This is just a wonderful sentence. That's, to me, the heart of this whole piece. We offer ourselves to ourselves, and we offer others to others. We offer ourselves to ourselves, and we offer others to others. What does that mean? How is it that we offer, I think we can kind of wrap our minds on offering ourselves to ourselves. There's an expression Katagiri Roshi used to use a lot, and settle yourself on yourself. To be yourself. Suzuki Roshi said, when you are you, Zen is Zen. To be truly yourself, not in the small sense, but in the sense of including what's incomprehensible and vast about our life. When we can do that, mysteriously, then giving others to others. And I think we've all encountered that with friends, teachers, people that we meet. Somehow, if we're encountering somebody who is very comfortable with themselves, then mysteriously we feel free. That's the bodhisattva path. First, but we have to be able to give ourselves to ourselves. That's one stage. But the other way to do it is to give, the other way to give ourselves to ourselves is to meet each person with complete respect and honor, recognizing that they are Buddha. This is not always so easy. It doesn't matter which way we work. You can work from the inside out or the outside in. Doesn't matter. Ultimately, it will have the same far-reaching effect. I remember, whenever I'm here, I think about Kobenchino Roshi, naturally, you know. I remember encountering him at Tassajara in the 80s, and he came down. I think he was helping with some Dharma transmissions that were happening then. And he came and sort of lived with us during the practice period for a time. And he gave a talk. And I remember nothing of the talk. Not a single word. I have no idea what it was about. I just remember walking out of the stone dining room feeling great happiness. And I found myself next to Reb Anderson. And I was just talking about this, and I said, what is that? And he said, oh, that's Dharma joy. You know, it was just the joy and freedom that I was experiencing directly, that was transmitted directly, not to me personally, but I just absorbed from a person who was really completely at ease with himself. I feel that also around Hoitsu Suzuki, Suzuki Roshi's son. It's very clear from talking to Suzuki Roshi's heirs that that's what they felt. But then it's practice. You have to broaden this out. For Suzuki Roshi's heirs, with all due respect, they all felt that when they were around him. And then when he was gone, they actually didn't get along so good. So they fought for about 30 or 40 years. But they remembered how he was, what they learned from, what they embodied, what he embodied, that they embodied, kept them on the path to working with each other. So that's giving. I'm aware of the time. I don't want to go on too long, and I don't think it's necessary to, but sort of as a bookend to that, in this last section on identity action, the first line is, identity action means not to be different. Identity action means to be the same as. And then he says, neither different from self nor different from others. So not to set up barriers between people, but really, as a matter of practice, what's hard is to observe the barriers within myself, to see how one unreconstructed part of me still can be selfish and wants to be self-serving. And yet there's also a part that is pretty much on the bodhisattva path. So to unify those two, to actually see, in a sense, how the part of me that is so-called selfish is just a being who is yearning for everything, to be in connection with everything, which is not so unusual. It comes out for each of us in sort of weird and not always such functional ways. But really, it's human. This desire is human. But how do I unify that? How do I embrace myself? So I really encourage you, if you have a chance to study this fascicle by Dogen, you can. I really encourage you. I think it's really precious. For me, it's been what's guided me in daily life in many ways, and what's guided me in my practice in the world, and in the practice of Zazen as well, because the practice of Zazen is nothing other than the enactment of unifying with yourself and perceiving those odd moments when you're at separation. I just loved sitting here this morning, and it's a little hard even to speak because the sitting was just perfect. And sometimes it was just merging and falling away, and sometimes, you know, there was perception and various thoughts and plans arose and setting them aside. But the attempt to just embrace myself and to feel embraced by all of us sitting together, which is seems like a very ordinary and at once extraordinary activity. So anyway, just in a moment of shameless promotion, just to say that the text is in this book, and I have some copies of the book, which I'll just set out, and you can look through it. We have lunch after this, right?
Yeah.
So I'd like to sing you some, but first, is there any question or any thought before we sing? Yeah. I think that it's interesting. I think I come from a particular cultural background, which is Jewish from New York. And so I was talking with somebody about this yesterday, because it's a problem that I get into with my teacher, Sojin. You know, he believes calm, beneficial speech, or kind speech, should be very kind and gentle, which is true. That's good. And I also believe that that I owe somebody. My mode is, okay, let's get it out there. Let's put it on the table and talk about it respectfully. Let's argue. It's just an idea. It's not life and death. And if we are able vigorously to exchange, so I'm basically talking about a vigorous exchange of ideas and words in a lively and sometimes intense way. And that's okay. Some cultures, that's really how you express love. When it goes astray, then it turns into, you know, ad hominem attacks, or you make it, you know, personal. But just to say, I feel I owe somebody the respect of really sharing my full view, not just saying, yes, that's very nice. You know, you're right. I love you. You know, it's like, you can see it doesn't look too authentic on me, does it? And when you look at, you know, look at all the koan collections, you know, they are disputes and challenges that are vigorous and respectful. So that's also embracing. It's fully respecting somebody so that you can put all views on the table. That's the way we allow things to develop. So does that make sense? Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
I appreciate.
There's the ultimate question. So, the way is what, in Japanese, I think it's do. In Chinese, it's dao. And you are never apart from it. And yet sometimes we can't see it. And sometimes the challenge is, wherever you are, to find yourself on the way. So if you view it, you know, in a kind of material way as a path, like that path out there with with the white stones. You know, well, you could wander off into the weeds, and you think, oh, I'm off the path. However, you are someplace else, and wherever you are, there is something really important that you can learn. In that sense, you're never apart from the way. So sometimes, you know, we think there's a path of practice or a path of training, which is true. But really what that path is to be at home, to be fully wherever you are. If you're lost, then the way is, I'm lost. Now what? And that's the functional question for Zen is how? You know, how do I practice? How is this the way? And it seems like this is absolutely the opposite. But if you really, if you look deeply, then you find where you are. Then you've given, you're giving yourself to yourself. Does that make some sense? Well, let me sing you this song, okay? So this is a song that was written by Greg Fain, who's the present Tonto at Tassajara. People know him?
Yes.
And a guy named Ben Gustin. And written a number of years ago. And they were studying the Lotus Sutra. So this is a chapter of the Lotus Sutra in its just fantastic condensation. And it's a chapter about the Bodhisattva never despise, the Bodhisattva never disparage. And you'll get, I don't need to explain who he is, but this is, I mean, read the chapter, it's really amazing. And the Lotus Sutra is a wonderful, accessible book, and I encourage you to read it. Next week we're actually having an all-day recitation of the Lotus Sutra, where people are coming together to read the entire book, which you can do in about 6 or 7 hours at Berkeley Zen Center. But it's full of parables and stories about skillful means, how to find the way wherever you are. There's a book called the Lotus Sutra that you really ought to know about. It's a holy book that has the power to remove all fear and doubt. And this book tells the story of a man who means the world to me, who could just as well have been a woman, except for male hegemony. So they call him the Bodhisattva Never Disparage, or the Bodhisattva Never Despise. And I'm making it my life's ambition to see the world through his pure eyes. Because he says, I will never disparage you or keep you at arm's length. Where you only see your weaknesses, I only see your strength. I would never despise you or put you down in any way. Because it's clear to me, I can plainly see, you'll be a Buddha someday. So that's the chorus. You're going to sing this. I will never disparage you or keep you at arm's length. I will never disparage you or keep you at arm's length. Where you only see your weaknesses, I only see your strength. Where you only see your weaknesses, I only see your strength. I would never despise you or put you down in any way. I would never despise you or put you down in any way. Because it's clear to me, I can plainly see, you'll be a Buddha someday. Because it's clear to me, I can plainly see, you'll be a Buddha someday. Good. Now Bodhisattva never disparaging, lived countless kalpas in the past. In the time of the counterfeit Dharma, and he was something of an outcast. because the monks and nuns of his time, they were noted for their arrogance and vanity. And these were the folks who exercised great power and authority. But my boy, he never concerned himself if they treated him like a freak. He just bowed to everybody equally, and these are the words he speaks. I will never disparage you or keep you at arm's length. Where you only see your weaknesses, I only see your strength. I would never despise you or put you down in any way, because it's clear to me, I can plainly see, you'll be a Buddha someday. I love you. That's what he says. He never read or recited the scriptures much. He only liked to practice respect. But the monks and nuns of his time, they didn't meet it like you might expect. So they cursed him, and they reviled him, and they wished that he would go, because they all had self-esteem issues, like everybody else I know. So they beat him and pelted him with clubs and stones. They tried to drive him away, but he just run off to a safe distance, and he turned around and say, I will never disparage you or keep you at arm's length. Where you only see your weaknesses, I only see your strength. I would never despise you or put you down in any way, because it's clear to me, I can plainly see, you'll be a Buddha someday. And so it went on for years and years. He was a target of scorn and abuse. Still our hero, he shed no tears, nor did he ever wonder, what's the use? Until he came to the end of his natural lifespan, and he lay down, fixing to die. And he heard the Holy Lotus Sutra being preached up in the sky, and his life was expanded for millions of years. He's living to this day. And in the pages of the Lotus Sutra, you still can hear him say, I will never disparage you or keep you at arm's length. Where you only see your weaknesses, I only see your strength. I would never despise you or put you down in any way, because it's clear to me, I can plainly see, you'll be a Buddha someday. Yes, it's clear to me, I can plainly see, you'll be a Buddha someday. I love you. Thank you. Should we chant the four vows to end?
That felt like a chant. Yes.
Means all.